Conquer the Noise is a podcast produced by Unconquered, an independent agency challenging brand perspective to redefine content. This podcast is dedicated to telling stories of outstanding ideas and people who have found their way amongst the chatter.
Hi, everyone. Welcome. I'm Jonathan Hansen, the Chief Creative Officer at Unconquered, and I'm your host of Cultivating Purpose and Passion in Business. Thank you so much for listening in today. We are speaking with Stephen Dime, co-founder and CEO of Flowers for Dreams. But before we kick things off, I would love to hear from you. So please head on over to the Apple Podcast app and leave a review or email me at j@weareunconquered.co. I really hope this has been an informative and inspiring podcast as you think about yourself, your business, and how you can roll it all into creating a more purposeful and sustainable life. All right, Stephen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Good to be here.
How are you? How has everything been since we last chatted?
It's been great. We're excited here in Chicago in the Midwest for warm weather, finally. Actually, it was pretty abrupt transition, which is unusual. So went from 0 degrees to 60 degrees in a hurry, getting our spring flowers in. So all good vibes on our end.
So I guess that's a good point. Do you use greenhouses or is everything being grown outside on farms locally?
It's a great question. So we just are exiting the season where most of our flowers are still pretty international from warm weather climates. Uh-huh. And this is a special March and April are special period because we get to activate our local farms, a couple of which we have ownership in, a couple of which we support as their primary or sole buyer. We work with about 25 Midwest farms, and we work with some farms outside of our region in the Carolinas right now and further south. So it's an exciting time to be able to support our local farmers.
Yeah, what I found really interesting as I dug in to learn more about Flowers for Dreams, I just found your founding story super interesting, how you even entered this space. I would love for it if you could share with our listeners how you got here and what sort of spurred the whole creation of this growing business.
Yeah, absolutely. The truth is I am a florist by accident. I'm an entrepreneur by accident. Both started in my late teen years by accident. I was 19 years old when I was introduced to both flowers and business. A friend of mine who eventually became my roommate in university at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I grew up in Chicago. He had come from a long lineage of florists, floral wholesalers, and when he was growing up, he worked at his dad's wholesale florist in New England, boxing flowers, processing florists at a register, and then taking his dad's excess floral inventory at the end of the week after working all week and selling it. We refer to the excess inventory in flowers as spoilage, mm-hmm. or waste. And instead of wasting it, he would take it from his dad and bundle it up into bouquets, selling it at graduation ceremonies, commencements, proms, concerts, all sorts of school events that happened in the early part of summer, mm-hmm. when he's on summer break. And he kind of introduced me to this as a way to make money. And I was a freshman in college, eager to make money. I kind of had a deal with my parents on how we'd pay for school. So right out of the gate in school, I started working in the cafeteria. I became a house party DJ. I was looking, mm-hmm. for any which way, mm-hmm. to help pay for school. And this sounded to me as a unique and kind of brilliant idea, buying flowers for $0, essentially, the spoilage, mm-hmm. and reselling them to parents at graduation, at concerts and proms for $30, $40. So though I was not a business person, I knew that was a pretty good margin set up. And I said, hey, can I do the same thing you're doing in New England in Chicago? Can I get some of those excess flowers, or where can I get some of those excess flowers? And I'd like to sell them outside graduations. So by the next summer, I became my own flower peddler. And soon thereafter, I got a few of my buddies, my high school friends in the Chicago area, to join me selling flowers on the street, even at gas stations and on a Mother's Day and up to people's car windows, at again graduations or commencements and proms. And we kind of just took over the whole Chicago area. First, it started with just like our high schools in our area selling flowers, in most cases impermissibly outside, mm-hmm. of their ceremonies. And then eventually in tandem with the schools, And we built this kind of seasonal college flower business where we became the school's florist of record. We did their prom, the boutonnieres, the corsages, we did their commencement. And maybe the most neat thing about it was that the school was actually kind of a winner in this partnership. They would get a cut of the total flower sales as a student fundraiser, or to fund the senior class gift or a scholarship program, which was a big win for them, the PTAs and the schools themselves. So that was pretty easy to engage those stakeholders. And then on the other side, we came up with this very, at the time, it was kind of on a whim. And it wasn't because we were the most altruistic people, but it was as really a marketing idea from a friend, that every bouquet we'd sell, because the margin had so much room, $0 to buy, $40 to sell, that we could afford to possibly buy a backpack or school supplies for a lower income student who wasn't graduating that day, but hopefully would one day soon graduate, as a way to make this whole process and project full circle and to really, again, engage the school. So In summary, we created this college flower business that sold flowers at graduations, gave a cut of the sales to the school itself to fund their own objectives, a fundraiser, a scholarship, a senior class gift, et cetera. And at the same time, we would give a portion of that sale to buying a backpack complete with school supplies for a Chicago public school student in need. Mm-hmm. And that first summer, the very first summer we did it, we gave over 500 backpacks to three different schools in the inner city of Chicago. And it launched the rest of kind of my career. 10 years later, I'm still selling flowers for a purpose. After college, we turned what was this small college business into Flowers for Dreams, which today sells similarly beautiful bouquets to advance causes of justice and charity in the communities we serve. Every bouquet we sell benefits a local charity. We give one quarter of our profits to a different local nonprofit every single month in each of the communities we serve. And to date, that's resulted in over $750,000 donated, all from the sale of flowers.
Yeah, I think one of the things I love about that founding story, just as an entrepreneur and founder myself, is just how you just went for it. And it wasn't this thing of like, I don't know if I can do this. There wasn't a whole lot of consideration on the fact that you hadn't even finished school or studied business. You just kind of went for it. And I think that's like the epitome, and I hate to sound sort of cliche in some ways, but of like the American dream, or the dream of being a business owner. You know, in that story, if there's anything that you would want listeners at home to take away from, what would that be, just from those early days of your story?
Yeah, it's been a long journey, and I think it's hard to replicate the naivete of a 19-year-old.
Yeah,
you know, I think that was in a sense my competitive advantage at the time. When I think about it, looking back, you know, I didn't know what I didn't know. Mm-hmm. Right. I didn't know what I was even jumping into. I certainly didn't know this would become my future and the bulk of my next decade of my life and my career. And all of those things actually worked to my advantage because I didn't overthink it. Like you said, I just kind of jumped in. I got a cart from Home Depot. I got some flowers shipped in from Florida to my parents' garage. I put two air conditioners, in the garage. We put a tarp up to split my parents' garage, which is formerly a two-car garage, became a one-car garage, so I can make a makeshift cooler to house the flowers. And it just kind of happened. There wasn't some grand plan. There wasn't a big vision at the time. Mm-hmm. It was a college hustle, a side gig, a seasonal gig. And, you know, my lesson or piece of advice, although it's difficult to replicate that naivete, as I said, it's important, it's useful to not overthink it. I think there is a line to the effect of, if it's perfect, if your product is perfect and you're supremely confident in it, you released it too late. You released it too late. You need to, I designed our first logo. It was embarrassing. It kind of looks like the AOL instant messenger guy with like a little clip art flower in his arm. And it was pink and purple were our brand colors. This is even once we started Flowers for Dreams when I was 21, 22. And, you know, we kept iterating, we kept figuring it out. And so no one's first product is perfect. Certainly not the people who are successful. As I said, it's too late. So that's what I would probably say is one of my biggest takeaways from the early days, is just jumping into it and appreciating my naivete as really an advantage.
Yeah, I mean, I feel the same way. And sometimes I think back on my earlier days and college days, and I was very active and a young entrepreneur then, and had some successes. And there are moments where I was like, wow, I cannot believe we did that. Whereas I don't think now I would have the audacity. And there are times where I when I'm questioning or hesitating, I often will like to think back to those times and just say, you know what, just do it. Like there's a power in not knowing. I hate to say it, but sometimes just not knowing all the potential outcomes is actually advantageous, because it helps some of those fears just like slip away, and allows you just to dive in.
Completely. And I'd add, like, you couple the naivete with an extreme curiosity, or I guess thirst to learn. Mm-hmm. And it's a really great combination for an entrepreneur. You don't know what you don't know, and that's, oh, and you've accepted that, and you're really interested in learning. And that becomes like kind of the baseline, I think, to jump in.
And so you're an early adapter of the B Corporation certification.
Yes.
At what point did you start connecting the dots between doing good, because you had that give back component early on, and really starting to like think about this as a full holistic approach to doing business?
Yeah, so I think the least accidental part of our story, or my story in particular, is the social entrepreneurship piece. I think early on, when I had decided to start making this a serious run at this being a career and a real business and a full-time effort, I knew I wanted to incorporate what I'd been learning and studying in school. This is what I wanted to actually build my career on, which was neither flowers nor business. It was really, you know, social justice activism. You know, I studied political science, social policy, Middle East studies in particular. I actually grew up wanting to be in like the CIA and FBI until I was 18. And so I had always been really interested in the civic and public sector and how to advance our goals and values in that world. And so I knew early on, I mean, it's kind of in our name, Flowers for Dreams, that we wanted to integrate giving fundamentally into the business model. So B Corp kind of, you know, right when we decided that we were going to integrate giving fundamentally in the business model, we started looking for other people that were doing something similar. At this point, the term social enterprise or social entrepreneur was still, you know, in smaller corners of the business world. It wasn't a popularized term the way it is today. And I love that it's now popularized. And we certainly didn't call ourselves that. It worked well. We saw the impact right away from a cause marketing perspective. It helped our business grow, having such a well-integrated, authentic giving story and clear mission. And it was the most fulfilling thing we did. It's fun to sell the flowers. We're a flower company first. But the thing that wakes me up every day in the morning, the thing that woke me up that first summer, was handing the backpacks and school supplies on a school bus to the kids at Manuel Perez and Chicago Youth Centers and Belmont Cragen, kids that I would have otherwise never interacted with. I grew up relatively well off and didn't grow up with these kids who didn't have basic school supplies. We're reusing a textbook from 10 years ago, or sharing a backpack with their sister. So this was the thing that really motivated me. And to your question about B Corps, we started looking for other people doing something similar. Who's doing this? Where is it happening? There was a small B Corp meetup in Chicago. And by small, it was 10 of us. And the listserv might have been 20. And there was only, I think at the time, 10 or 15 B Corps in the state of Illinois. But we all thought the same way. We thought that you don't have to make compromises. We were seeing it in our own, like, you know, day-to-day evidence running our businesses, that you don't have to make compromises between your values and profit. And that profit isn't the point in business. And that's a little unusual. And so I think we all were aligned on that in B Corp. And I started studying B Corporations, and I really wanted to help kind of be a pioneer. And since that time, 2015, 2016, B Corps have grown, I think, to 2,000 or 3,000 internationally. I don't have the number offhand.
It's around 3,000. It's between
3,000.
It's between 2,500 and 3,000. Yeah, it's growing quickly.
Remarkable.
Yeah. It's funny, earlier in my career, you know, I should say even my career when I was younger in high school, you know, I had the dream of being that I wanted to be a business owner, but, or at least on the corporate side, grow and be a CEO or be like this power business person. You know, I think part of it came from the influence of seeing my father come down every morning before he owned his own business, but he wore a suit to work, and just seeing him in a suit and just kind of like seeing this idea of what, you know, like a role model in many ways, but just kind of this idea of like, this is what success looks like in some ways, you know. And I didn't really think about business in the sense of being able to use it for good. I had this very like old corporate idea of like crush anyone, profits, make lots of money, climb to the top, you know. And as I've gotten older and own my own business now for over 10 years, and it's completely changed. And I'm all about challenging this status quo of the way capitalism has to be, the way business has to be. And I don't know if it's just like uniquely American in some ways, but there's this whole new like wave of businesses being developed that are now all around sustainability. They have strong, and when I say sustainability, I don't mean just necessarily environmental, but there's an element of supporting community, an element of helping nonprofits that just wasn't there before. And, you know, as the agency has really explored this idea and explored these companies, you know, we've been just philosophically talking about the ideas of ethical consumerism. You know, where does responsibility fall? Is it on regulation? Should be regulation be requiring businesses to change and do these things? Should the person buying these products be the one? Are they one who are really going to cause and force to change? And I think there's a really interesting conversation in there.
Right.
So I'm really curious to what your thoughts are and like where you think some of the responsibility falls, or between customer and business, because it seems like just from the outside looking at Dreams or Flowers for Dreams, you're very much believing that it starts with the business, is what I'm assuming. But right. I would love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I if you don't mind, I want to speak to that first point, like the difference in generations. You growing up and seeing that your father, I'm sure, was probably really interested in the social sector too, but they were compartmentalized, right? Like what they did in their day job, they made money, they rose through the corporate ranks, and then maybe on the side, many people on the side, right? I mean, like the generation before us and the boomers were super socially active, super mm-hmm. the first generation in the sense that challenged the status quo on such a mainstream level, but mm-hmm. that was the side hustle, or it was their, you know, it wasn't compatible, I should say, mm-hmm. with the business or their career. And I think I grew up hearing that same thing a lot, which was, oh, if you want to make a change, you got to first rise through the corporate ranks, make a whole bunch of money, and then you'll have the levers to give to the nonprofits you care about, start a foundation, do those types of things. You know, and there was no, but can I do I have to wait until I'm 50, 60, 70, I've made a whole bunch of money to start being interested in the world? Mm-hmm. Or can I do that my whole career up to that point? And I think, you know, again, with Flowers for Dreams, that idea certainly wasn't in my mind growing up, but I found through growing this business that those things are compatible. Our generation's finding that it's compatible. I'm a big believer to your point about capitalism, that there are win-win situations, that you can both make money, make profit, mm-hmm. handsome profit. You know, I'm a believer in, you know, limited or low profit liability companies, and how we structure that is just a different type of goalpost. But I want to engage a lot of companies on being able to really still keep profit central for them, while it might not be as central for us, and be able to make an impact and advance their values and care about their community. I believe that you can kind of do both. And I'm kind of like a big tent social entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. I would like more and more people. And I know there's challenges now as it's become mainstream with greenwashing and performative or inauthentic social justice in business. But I'm also seeing the youngest generation, the generation after us, be able to see the differences mm-hmm. and call out the differences, which is going to be even an amazing next step for capitalism, for social business, for things like this, where really, you got to make sure that you are integrating giving or the community or good corporate governance or environmental sustainability authentically and fundamentally in the business. A post on social media isn't sufficient. It's mm-hmm. fine, but it isn't sufficient. And no customer is going to reward you for that. No community is going to see you as a legitimate partner. And so I'm excited for the next generation to kind of take this and even a step further. We're seeing it happen. We saw it happen this year. Mm-hmm. So that's where I think capitalism has to go, right? Because a lot of people, to your last point, a lot of people have lost faith as only a very small segment of the population has seemingly benefited from the fruits of capitalism. Mm-hmm. And we need to figure out a way to make that those fruits more equitable and spread throughout our society. And so we talk a lot about, you know, helping drive a more human-centered capitalist community. I am a capitalist, and more, inclusive capitalism, more accountable capitalism. And so I think it starts, you know, with everybody you named, the regulators, the companies, the consumers. We all are going to be participants in this equally. But I know what I can do running a business, you know, with dozens, almost 100 employees, what I can do on a day-to-day basis, what I can do over the long term. And that's what I'm focusing on. And I think we've brought a lot of people with us, entrepreneurs, customers, to advance, you know, causes we care about and integrate giving into business.
Well, 25%, I mean, that's an amazing number. I actually haven't heard of any other companies, or at least that we've even spoken with, do 25%. I know earlier, in one of our earlier episodes, we spoke with a brand out of the UK, a fashion brand, and they had very lofty goals as well, and were doing around 25% or more, but they just couldn't, as a startup, they couldn't afford it to give out that much money, and so they had to scale back after that, and then sort of gradually increase as they grew. How do you balance that between figuring out what you can give and also maintaining growing a business and supporting staff and growth? And when I say growth, I mean geographic growth as well. How did you get to that 25% number and figure that out?
Yeah, well, it wasn't that thoughtful at the beginning. We didn't do a bunch of user research or testing. Mm-hmm. It happened. We kind of thought of a pie, you know, four slices, you know, a quarter for us, a quarter for the community, a quarter for our investors or the people who kind of believed us early on, and a quarter for our team. And that was like, you know, employees, owners, investors, community. That was the way we thought about it. Mm-hmm. Now we give 25% of our profits, and we make a really good distinction, I think, between profits and sales, which is unusual. Usually mm-hmm. the giving's tied to like 1%, 2% or some percentage of sale, 1% for the planet of mm-hmm. sales. When we weren't profitable, our number was 2.5% of sales. Mm-hmm. And so it's key for people to understand, like we give a quarter of our profits. So when we talk about at the end of the day, right, in that four slices of pie, it's we need to make money. We're not a nonprofit. And mm-hmm. that's what I think has been maybe unique about the Flowers for Dreams story, is that performance matters. And I don't think the sales really measures the holistic performance of the company. We have to not only be able to sell a dollar, but make a few cents on that dollar, which we mm-hmm. do, and we've been profitable most of the time in our life cycle as a company. So we kind of happened on it, with very unstrategically, and it's become a notable part of our business. And now we've created a foundation, our own Flowers for Dreams Foundation, a nonprofit with a board and an advisory committee that's made up of not just our team, not just our owners, but of the community, kind of just like the pie that we initially created when we were starting the business. Mm-hmm. And it's been pretty amazing to watch other people, stakeholders from inside and outside the company, be able to help drive our giving greater and greater and, you know, further into the future.
Mm-hmm. It seems like transparency is a big value that you, or I should say Flowers for Dreams hold. And I say that just after spending time on the site, seeing how open you are about where money's going, how much each nonprofit has received so far, how are you seeing, or how do you see transparency as a force for good?
Yeah, on our website, you noted, you can see every single donation we've ever made, the dollar amount, which nonprofit it went to. You can link to that nonprofit's website. We also link to our B Corp impact report card. B Corporation, as international NGO, audits us every other year, makes sure we're doing what we're saying we're doing, and grades mm-hmm. us. Mm-hmm. Some of our scores have gotten demonstrably better. Some of our scores have gotten worse on governance or sustainability or stakeholder inclusion, all these different categories that B Corp evaluates on. So all of that is available. Yes, I think it is better to be transparent because, as I said, this next generation in particular is not just taking companies at their word. I'm not going to name the big MNCs, multinational, big corporations that are trying to now build a sustainability architecture inside of their company, which is really difficult when you're at 30,000 global locations, right? How do you actually now start moving to zero waste? It's impossible, right? Mm-hmm. If they're telling you it's not, that's where it's going to require regulation and government intervention and things like that. If we really want these bigger corporations, the bigger polluters, the bigger net impactors to correct behavior and really change their business models. It's much easier to do it when you start for entrepreneurs out there. It's much easier to integrate giving, even something as simple as composting every day when you start versus once you're huge. I think that these are a lot of the good parts of this next generation and how we're viewing companies is you have to be more transparent. You have to really walk the walk. Mm-hmm. And we try and do that every day. And we try and give access to our customers to see everything we're doing, including B Corp to evaluate us. And again, we see benefits. We see trust gained between our community and us, between our customers and us. And we think that's one of our best attributes is kind of the trust that we share with our community.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's working because you're growing and you're expanding. So congratulations on just the recent expansion. I would love to hear, I mean, I'm originally from the Midwest, so it's nice to know that I can, from St. Louis. So now I'm glad I know I can send flowers from you in Missouri.
Anytime.
Where else are you shipping and how did you sort of start to expand into other states? I imagine that's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah, we moved very slowly. You know, there was many points throughout the beginning parts of Flower Surgeons where we're actually building momentum to kind of flip the switch and ship nationally, put our flowers in a box, send them on a UPS or FedEx mm-hmm. plane or truck for a couple of days and it arrived to your door. But we resisted that. We really tried to stay local for many reasons and grow inside our region and grow with our own supply chain. And so we've kind of built this hub and spoke model where Chicago is kind of the heartbeat of our operation, mm-hmm. the large fulfillment center here. We source all our own flowers. We design all our own flowers. We deliver all our own flowers. We've just recently started adding shipping in the adjacent states overnight to Illinois and Michigan, Wisconsin. But it took us 5 years to launch another market, which was Milwaukee, Wisconsin, after Chicago. And then we started serving most parts of Southeast Wisconsin and Northeast Illinois and spreading bigger and bigger. And now we're in across Michigan with locations in Detroit. And we intend to keep kind of growing throughout the Midwest. Our vision is to kind of become the flowers for dreams of the Midwest. We built, mm-hmm. I mentioned at the outset, 25 great local farm partners that we work with regularly. Now that it's March, April, May, most of our product is going to come from them. Mm-hmm. here in our community. And so we've built what I think is, and we've built a great ecosystem, great customers, awesome stakeholders, great charities that we support on a regular basis. And we're really excited to kind of usher in this craft flower movement here in our region, the same thing that's happened in other industries like coffee or beer, where independent, community-oriented, higher quality in some cases, alternatives have emerged mm-hmm. to like the big box players in the coffee and beer space, just like mm-hmm. we hope to do in flowers.
Mm-hmm. So as you expand, I mean, I guess there's got to be a strategy then if you're using, you know, the Chicago as your sort of your heartbeat, your hub, and then expanding outwards. And then what is that? Are you trying to serve specific communities since you have such a strong charitable aspect to the business? Are you trying to put or Flower for Dream stores or at least have charitable partners in areas that need that sort of support?
Yeah, to some extent. I think we've seen a trend really over the last 20 to 30 years where some of the greatest talent in this country, and this is kind of a little philosophical statement, but some of the greatest talent in this country has gravitated to the big cities, right? Mm-hmm. And to the big paying careers. We've seen many, many people, whereas again, the generation before us, Detroit was a city to settle in. Milwaukee was a city to settle in. Chicago is a city to settle in. Now we're seeing that we saw at least in the last few years, I think it's correcting, everyone go to New York, everyone go to San Francisco, everyone go to the urban areas the cities rather than the suburbs or rural communities. The Midwest had population loss. We had the most population loss of any region in the country since 2000. Detroit in particular is a city that's changed dramatically. And I think that there is a story there that's, again, really authentic because we're in these communities where we're trying to help be a part of the renaissance and rebuild of the Midwest and of these great cities that some might perceive as second or third tier cities, but they're big cities. They can support all major sports teams. They have really large economies. Detroit's economy, I think, is $600-700 billion a year. I mean, these are still major markets and should be able to attract talent, great businesses, entrepreneurs. And so that is, yeah, part of our strategy very intentionally to stay in this region that way.
Yeah, I'm definitely guilty of that as someone who grew up in the Midwest and left and has spent a lot of time on the coast.
No shame.
I love the Midwest. So always be home. I still go back and visit it, but I think there are some amazing cities. I think Chicago is an amazing city. Minneapolis has an incredible art and culture scene. And I went to school in Des Moines, Iowa, which is, you know, really when you start to think about the Midwest, you think about Iowa and these sort of like plain states. And I loved it. I think they made me a better person and helped shape my values that I hold now. So I think there's, like you're saying, I think there's a lot of value in sort of nurturing and continue to nurture those areas of the country. As you've grown, I'm curious to how, and you hinted at this earlier about spoilage and working with local farms to maybe cut down some of that transportation time. I'm sure that helps as far as spoilage is concerned. What are some of these other strategies that you're doing to reduce the waste?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, our whole model is kind of made to order, or just in time would be like a manufacturing term where we're only making those bouquets that we got for the day. So we do now have some storefront pieces, some retail shops where you can walk in and get flowers. Mm-hmm. But up until recently, our business was all like this online local hybrid where we didn't have to set up stores where flowers were being window dressed to either dye or sell. And in most cases, florists, in fact, in 2010, the number that our major trade association, the Society of American Florists, released, our industry, the average spoilage at a local florist was 36%. A third of their inventory dies. And that's just the cost of doing business. So you have to factor that in the price. And that's why there's a pretty big markup in flowers because of that huge spoilage cost that people contend with. Whereas our spoilage, because it's made to order, we don't have flowers waiting to either be sold or die. We're only executing the orders that come in online for the next day, we have a 6-8% spoilage rate pretty consistently, and that's considerably lower. So it's not only beneficial for the environment, of course, not only how we waste, but how much we waste, but it's also great for our business. You know, we can offer more competitive prices compared to the online companies. You know, a $30 or $40 cart to get a bouquet in Chicago is really, really competitive and really affordable, you know, outside of the grocery stores, just comparing to, you know, the local mom and pops and the big box companies. Again, getting something for $30 or $40 or $50, which is our goal, to your door, makes it also really compelling for profit, good in service, as well as, again, good for the environment.
It definitely makes it accessible. I was pretty surprised at your price points, just as someone who orders flowers regularly for people. You know, I don't think I've spent under $120 by the time you get delivery and everything, and it's crazy. It's really expensive.
That's kind of how it works because of the numbers I share.
Yeah, well, thanks for sharing it, Eliza. I've always wondered why flowers are so expensive. So, that makes sense. You know, you touched on this a little bit earlier about design. As far as, you know, your early logo, and I've spent some time on your social media, and you definitely have a strong aesthetic to your brand, and that's obviously purposeful. And I'm curious to what your thoughts were and what really sort of drove you to push and develop that design and brand side of the business.
Yeah, brand is really everything, and I don't have to tell people who listen to your guys' podcast and you and the agency that brand is everything. Storytelling is everything. So it's not just about how beautiful our products are, but it's about how we tell the story. So we've always used, there was a point, and it's one of our kind of earliest accolades, that Instagram named us one of the best brands to follow on Instagram, which was super validating. And you know, since the beginning, we've used our bouquets to tell stories and talk about our charities, and we've designed our bouquets in ways that we think stands out and visually, as well as in the real world, the analog world too. And so it's early on, we understood the power of brand. And after my initial iteration of the logo and the color scheme, we realized we needed some help. And ever since that, ever since we kind of redesigned the logo we have today and the color scheme we have today and the packaging we have today and all the elements that make up Flowers for Dreams, we've made design a fundamental part of the business and kind of never gone away from that. I think one really tangible way we did it is social media in our early days, 2012 to 2015, was becoming, that was its peak period, and still it was a newer frontier, and we were on it early. We cared about it a lot. Myself, my co-founder, were on it regularly. We didn't just hire like an unpaid intern who was, you know, younger than us and, hey, you figure out the social media, right? We were on it. We enjoyed it. We were on it personally. And we invested in it as a real job. Now, social media manager is a real job. Mm-hmm. It wasn't 7 to 10 years ago. And we're trying to find what the next, you know, areas are, right? So we're still in social media realm, TikTok. We're starting to invest in TikTok. How can we create good content in TikTok? We know it's not a big buying demo yet. It's still a younger, mostly a younger age demographic, but this is again the next generation, and we want them to love Flowers for Dreams as much as this generation hopefully does.
Well, I think you'd be surprised though when you think about brand and design and storytelling, how sometimes it takes a back seat, especially for early startups where, you know, money is really precious, and there's always that dilemma of where do we spend it. And it's, I think for people who are on the more, I don't want to say practical, but side of more of the numbers, return on investment, it's sometimes hard to wrap your head around how a brand influences purchasing, how it influences prices, how it, you know, it tells this brand story. And we have a lot of conversations with our clients about that. It's still an ongoing thing. That's one of the reasons why I wanted to ask to see how you approach it, because you've done such a great job over the last, or I should say since the beginning. Yeah. And it's just one of those constant things where we feel like there's always education. There's always something that we are learning and trying to bring into the fold of trying to help brands understand its value and embrace it and push forward when there's that idea of there's a little bit of the unknown. You're just not quite sure what it's going to do for you. So
for sure. And it's a constant conversation, and not everyone gets it. So that's why we need agencies, you know, like you guys, to be able to help people get it and help them craft their own story.
And you know, I've really enjoyed the conversation, and as we start to sort of wrap things up a little bit, I would love to hear, I think it's valuable to hear how you are listening to your customers. You know, it sounds like you're telling that story, but that's often when telling the story, there's the other side of listening to it, or listening to what your intended customers or potential customers are saying or wanting. And I'm curious how you're gauging some of that. And also, I mean, that runs in parallel with what we were just talking about, is how do you gauge the success of brand development? You know, how are you sort of, I think these things are very much related, and I'm curious to how you're measuring these things.
Yeah, I kind of have a weird take on this. I actually think, a mistake of companies is too often relying on user testing or surveys and user research and kind of over-listening. Again, a weirder take. Whereas what we try and do is we try and drive the conversation with our customers and actually serve as an educator to our customers. We want to teach them about flowers, like I was sharing with you about spoilage, right? Mm-hmm. Why are the prices the way they are? We want to teach them about our charities. Why should you care about this cause? We just posted, for example, on our social media about housing insecurity and homelessness, which I don't think tons of our customers are aware of. Because our customers, to be clear, are still generally more affluent. People who can send flowers frequently aren't in poverty, right? And they're certainly not low income. So how do we educate those customers on the causes we care about, why they are important? Mm-hmm. Again, why our prices are the way they are. So it's a conversation, no doubt. And I think we listen really well, but we also aren't afraid to lead and lead them where we want to go. And I think that's part of kind of what's made us special is instead of waiting for our customer to give us that next great idea, we want to introduce them to something they haven't thought of yet. That's something they didn't know they needed. I think that's kind of actually like a Steve Jobs sentiment, right? That we want to show the customer where we can go and take them there with us. And so I think that's part of it. But we do have like really integrated ways of listening. So we have a donation advisory committee. Our members, our nonprofit leaders, they can actually participate in which charities we're going to give a $5,000 or $10,000 or $20,000 grant to. And that's a really powerful kind of volunteer role for our community. And we listen to our farms. What flowers, we actually ask them, what flowers do you want to grow this season? And we'll make a big bulk pre-order of those flowers. So we kind of have some more integrated ways of listening. But I also think a useful maybe piece of advice or take on this is don't wait. Don't be too patient. Don't do too much testing. Don't do too much research or too many surveys. Where do you want to take the customer? You're the one who founded the business or you're one of the managers and you need to really be clear with your vision. It can't be some crowdsourced vision that is confusing and unclear and has too many voices in the huddle. So I think it's a combination of both in summary, but really thinking about leading.
See, I think that was a great way to end it and a great piece of advice. I'm going to end it there. And I appreciate the time and you sharing your knowledge and also just the work you're doing. I think it's really commendable. And, 25%, I'm amazed by that. I think it's awesome. So I will definitely be buying flowers from you. I know Lucy, who works as our producer on the podcast and is director of our business development, is a huge fan. She's the one that really was advocating to get you on the show and has been ordering with you for a long time. So we will definitely continue to support you all. And thank you for coming on.
Thank you guys so much. And Lucy, keep ordering.
Thank you all for listening in today. Next week, we have Coulter Lewis, CEO and founder of Sunday, a non-toxic lawn care product. We're going to dig into startup life, their recent $9.5 million investment, and how they are challenging legacy brands in the lawn care space. See you all next week.